Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago, and we've got a really fun show today. Excellent Grateful Dead show from 31 years ago today, September 30th, 1993, coming at you live from the Boston Garden in Boston, Massachusetts. And this is the original Boston Garden, which unfortunately I never had the pleasure of visiting, but I've heard from many of my Boston friends, including good buddy Alex, who's an original Boston guy, that, you know, it was like all the old NBA, NHL buildings, not unlike the old Chicago Stadium, where we used to go see the Bulls play till they opened up the United Center in the mid-90s. You know, kind of old, a little decrepit, balconies kind of hanging all over the place. You know, I always believe that one good puff of wind might be able to knock the whole damn thing over. But certainly when the Dead were there, it would light up and, you know, just be an amazing place. And you almost kind of appreciated the intimacy that it created because you were in a big arena, but it felt like you weren't. And so the old Boston Garden was really kind of a special place. Bobby Orr, you know, and all the great Celtics teams of the 60s and, you know, just kind of a little bit of living history. And the Grateful Dead are there. They played there quite a bit. But 31 years ago today, they're there, and this is how it started. Sunshine, one of my really favorite Grateful Dead tunes. It was released on the album Wake of the Flood on October 15th, 1973. And Wake of the Flood was the first album on the band's own Grateful Dead Records label. So kind of a cool bit of history there. You know, great song, great album, very cool circumstances. It was first performed by the Dead in February of 1973. It was played about 30 or so times through February of 74, and then for no apparent reason, it was dropped from the repertoire. The song ultimately returned back into their playlist in December of 92 at the instigation of Vince Welnick, of all people. It was then played a few times each year until 95. So think about that. God bless Vince Welnick. You know, sometimes I don't think he gets nearly enough credit for the circumstances he stepped into and the very fine services and performances that he provided for the band and the Deadheads. You know, he brought in a lot of some of those great other covers, the Baba O'Reilly Into Tomorrow Never Knows was his, and a few others, and those were just things that just spiced up concerts, especially during a period of time when the Dead were really kind of, you know, well, I shouldn't say the Dead as much as Jerry, were really kind of starting to fall off their game, and you know, there was a distinct possibility that on any given night you could see a real dud of a show if Jerry just wasn't feeling it and if the band was a little tired or whatever. But I thought Vince kept things, you know, moving and very interesting, and, you know, thank goodness he brought this tune back, because it's just too good of a tune for them not to have played. So here's the details on it. They only played it a total of 66 times. Again, and given what a beautiful song it is and when it was released in 73, that doesn't feel like nearly enough times for them to have played it. It was first played on February 9th, 1973, at the Maples Pavilion in Stanford University, Stanford, California. That's a great show, not unlike the October 19th, 71 show in Minnesota, where they released a bunch of new songs. At this show at Maples in February of 73, they released a bunch of new songs, and maybe one of these years it'll fall out on a Monday or close enough there to it that we can actually cover that show and feature all of that. Here Comes Sunshine was last played on July 2nd, 95 at Deer Creek Music Center in Noblesville, so it did actually, you know, still show up right at the very end, which I guess is kind of nice. But here's the thing, you know, as we said before, it was played a total of 32 times in 1973, the year it came out. It was played one time in 1974. And then it was not played again until December 6, 1992 at Compton Terrace out in Chandler, Arizona, 18 years later. What the hell? Where was that song for 18 years? They played it a few more times in 93, 94, 95, although never more than 11 times in any one year. I finally caught one in 1993 at the Rosemont Horizon in Chicago with good buddies Mark and Alex. My favorite version is February 15th, 1973 from the Dane County Coliseum in Madison, Wisconsin, which is one of my all-time favorite shows. But what I really like about this version of it is that, you know, it has that kind of a cappella opening where they're all out there, you know, kind of harmonizing and doing the introduction to the song like that. The versions that were played in 73 really didn't have that. They just basically came out and started jamming. And actually, part of the introduction was really part of the song that I love so much. But they get the introduction here. They just give us that little bit of extra a cappella. And considering that it's 93, and, you know, Jerry's voice certainly isn't as strong as it was. And as much as I love Vince Welnick, I can't say that his voice, you know, ever was quite as smooth or sweet as Brent's voice. And Bobby's Bobby, you know, and he's doing his thing. So, but here they all blend very nicely. It's really a lot of fun. They come right out of the gate with a fantastic tune that just has everybody rocking and rolling. And what a wonderful way to start a concert. And as I say, it's only just a shame that we didn't get a few more of those while they could have been played, a whole history of them. But we move on. And then at this show, the fun never ends. They give us a great Here Comes Sunshine opener, and then they immediately, we'll talk about this, they take a short little break, and then they dive right into this one. Spoonful is a blues song written by Willie Dixon, first recorded in 1960 by Howlin' Wolf and was released in June 1960 by Chess Records in Chicago. Called a stark and haunting work, it is one of Dixon's best known and most interpreted songs. Etta James and Henry Fuqua had a pop and R&B record chart hit with their duet cover of Spoonful in 1961, and it was popularized in the late 1960s by the British rock group Cream, the Eric Clapton supergroup. Dixon's Spoonful is loosely based on A Spoonful Blues, a song recorded in 1929 by Charlie Patton. Earlier related songs include All I Want Is a Spoonful by Papa Charlie Jackson and Cocaine Blues by Luke Jordan, 1927. The lyrics relate men's sometimes violent search to satisfy their cravings with a spoonful used mostly as a metaphor for pleasures, which have been interpreted as sex, love, and drugs, which is what rock and roll is really all about, isn't it? The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame listed Howlin' Wolf's Spoonful as one of the 500 songs that shaped rock and roll. It's ranked number 154 on Rolling Stone Magazine's 2021 list of the 500 greatest songs of all time, up from number 221 on its 2004 list. In 2010, the song was inducted into the Blues Foundation Hall of Fame Classic of Blues Records Recordings category. In a statement by the foundation, it was noted that Otis Rush has stated that Dixon presented Spoonful to him, but the song didn't suit Rush's tastes, and so it ended up with Wolf, and soon thereafter with Etta James. James' recording with Harvey Fuqua as Etta and Harvey reached number 12 on Billboard magazine's Hot R&B Sides chart and number 78 on its Hot 100 Singles chart. However, Wolf's original was the one that inspired so many blues and rock bands in the years to come. The British rock group Cream recorded Spoonful on their 1966 UK debut album, Fresh Cream. They were part of a trend in the mid-1960s by rock artists to record a Willie Dixon song for their debut albums. With the Dead, it was sung by Bobby, normally following Truckin' in the second set. This version that we just listened to is rare because it's the second song of the show and does not have a lead-in. In other words, Here Comes Sunshine ended, and then it stopped, and then after a brief pause, they dived into this song. When it follows Truckin', which is where I'm more used to seeing it and hearing it, the jamming never stops as they just flow straight from Truckin' and pick up the beat for Spoonful seamlessly and go right into it. It was always exciting to get to hear Spoonful because it kind of stretched out the Truckin' jam. It wasn't Truckin' obviously anymore, but because it flowed right into the next one, it just felt like this long out extended jam that was wonderful to hear. A great introduction for all of us to Willie, although the Dead covered a number of his tunes, so this certainly wasn't the only one, but certainly a great one. The boys seemed to like it. They played it 52 times. The first was on October 15th, 1981 at the Melkweg in Amsterdam, Netherlands, a history-making show because they played a lot of songs, Hully Gully and a few others that didn't get a lot of playing time after that, although Spoonful did get some. It was ultimately, as we say, played 52 times. And its final performance was December 8th, 1994 at the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum. So not quite to the very end of things, but certainly within the last year of the Dead playing, it was still making an appearance every now and then. And great to see that too. Again, just another example of the versatility of the Dead, if you will, and their great range of the different type of music styles that they covered, from the cowboy numbers to the psychedelic rock to the more Americana to straight rock and roll to blues to jazz, everything. There was nothing out there that wasn't potentially in their wheelhouse to be able to cover and to play. And of course, there's lots of bands out there now that do this and do it really well. Fish, and I was just talking the other last week about how well Goose is with their covers. And as you're going to hear in a few minutes, we've got, in fact, very shortly now, another cover. In fact, that's a really great lead-in. So what we're going to do is we're going to dive right over here into the music news. And apropos with what I was just saying, Dan, what do you have for our lead-in today as we head into music news?
She's a rich girl.
So That song is Rich Girl, and if you're as old as I am, you know that it's a Hall & Oates tune. If you're not quite as old as I am, you might think that it's a Gwen Stefani tune, and a number of other people who have covered it over the years, but it is, in fact, a Hall & Oates song, and it debuted on... that debuted on the Billboard Top 40 on February 5th, 1977 at number 38. And on March 26, 1977, it became their first of six number one singles on the Billboard Hot 100. The song originally appeared on the 1976 album Bigger Than the Both of Us. At the end of 1977, Billboard ranked it as the 23rd biggest hit of the year. The song was rumored to be about the then-scandalous newspaper heiress Patty Hearst. In fact, the title character in the song is based on a spoiled heir to a fast food chain who is an ex-boyfriend of Daryl Hall's girlfriend, Sarah Allen. But you can't write "You're a rich boy" in a song, so I changed it to "a girl," Hall told Rolling Stone. He elaborated on the song in an interview with American Songwriter. Rich Girl was written about an old boyfriend of Sarah's from college that she was still friends with at the time. His name was Victor Walker. He came to our apartment and he was acting sort of strange. His father was quite rich. I think he was involved with some kind of fast food chain. I said, this guy's out of his mind, but he doesn't have to worry about it because his father's going to bail him out of any problem he gets into. So I sat down and wrote that chorus and he started singing it. He can rely on the old man's money. He can rely on the old man's money. He's a rich guy. I thought that that didn't sound right, so I changed it to Rich Girl. By the way, he knows the song was written about him. So that's an amazing amount of transparency being provided there to us by Daryl Hall regarding this song. But, you know, for me, it was just a song that, again, screamed high school, 1970s, kind of by the time we were beginning college in 1980, it was still being sung a lot. And then somewhere along the way, it just kind of dropped off the radio airplay and didn't come up very often. And, you know, occasionally on a golden oldie station or something like that, it would pop on. But it's a fun song, a great sing-along song. Just comes right out, leading off with the lyrics, which I really like. And, you know, I liked Hall & Oates. I thought that they put out a lot of great music. I know that for the last few years, they've been involved in various financial disputes and litigation. It's always a shame to see guys who spent so much time together making so many people happy, not being able to get along. But it happens in this world. And when it does, all we can do is move on and just say, hey, that was one part of my life. Hopefully I learned something from it, but now I'm on to bigger and better things, and we move on. And I wish the best for Daryl Hall and John Oates, and if they ever want to play together again, I'd certainly be willing to listen to their music. So this song, though, that we're listening to was actually a cover. We were talking about covers, and this version of this song was recorded by a band, Lake Street Dive, who we're going to talk about more in 1 minute, back on May 9th, 2018, at the College Street Music Hall in New Haven, Connecticut. Lake Street Dive has only recently come into my consciousness in the last year. They're an American multi-genre band that was formed in 2004 at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. The band's founding members are Rachel Price, Mike McDuck Olson, Bridget Kearney, and Mike Calabrese. Keyboardist Aki Burmese joined the band on tour in 2017 and was first credited on their 2018 album, Free Yourself Up. Guitarist James Corneliuson joined in 2021 after Olson left the band. The band is based in Brooklyn and frequently tours in North America, Australia, and Europe. When they were formed, they originally styled themselves as a free country band. They intended to play country music in an improvised avant-garde style. The concept was abandoned in favor of something that actually sounded good, according to Mike Olson. The band's name was inspired by the Bryant Lake Bowl, a frequent hangout in the band's early years located on Lake Street in Minneapolis. So give them a little bit of Midwest street cred there, too, and certainly Minneapolis. Home to lots of famous rockers, or influencer of many famous rockers, and here we go, seeing how they're encouraging on yet another band. This past Thursday night, I went with my wife and some of our good friends, JT and Marnie and Rick and Ben, to the Salt Shed in Chicago, which has been the site of a number of great great concerts here at the tail end of this year, with even still more to come. Mount Joy playing there in a week or two, I believe. Don't know if I'm going to make Mount Joy or not. Not really familiar with them, but so far saw Goose, and that was great. Saw Lake Street Dive Thursday night, and that was great. So if I can make the time, I may have to make it over there for Mount Joy. Otherwise, John and Marnie will tell me what I missed, I'm sure. We were sitting in the back near the top of the bleachers, which has become a regular location to go because it's got a killer view of the Chicago skyline. looking from the west side to southeast and right along the north branch of the Chicago River. You got a great view of the stage. The sound is wonderful. Beautiful weather. A great night overall. As I say, it was my first time seeing the band, although good buddies Alex, Andy, and Mikey had seen them at Red Rocks in July and all spoke very highly of the band, which is a good enough endorsement for me and for my wife, Judy. We've learned that when Alex especially, but Mike and Andy too, recommend band, you go see that band. You miss it at your own risk. Now, I didn't really know any of the other songs, but it didn't matter because they were very, very good. And then one of their encores was Rich Girl, which made me smile because, as I said, it's a song back in high school and all of that. And combined with having just seen Goose cover the 1970s hit Hollywood Nights by Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band, it was another trip down memory lane. I would recommend seeing this band to any fan of fun music. They were all clearly having a fun time. I have to say that Rachel Price, the vocalist, I love her voice. I love the way she inflects it, and I love the way she sings Rich Girl. That was the first song I actually, my wife and I were listening to them on our way to the concert, and we heard them sing Rich Girl, and I kind of perked up and said, wow, this is really great. All of the musicians were wonderful. Aki Bernice sang a song or two. They played another couple of songs that he wrote, kind of a funny guy with a regular patter going on in between songs. And everybody else was just up there basically hanging and I think just really doing a great job. But it was really fun to see them. Like I say, I would clearly go back and see them again, and I would recommend them to anyone who just loves going and seeing fun music. Very relaxed, very laid back. And the show was opened by Katy Prewitt, who then later on came out to sing a song with Lake Street Dive. In 2017, Prewitt was awarded the Buddy Holly Prize from the Songwriters Hall of Fame and signed with Round Hill Records. Her extended play, Our Vinyl Live Session, was released in March 2018. She was named by Rolling Stone as one of the 10 new country artists you need to know, and by NPR as one of the 20 artists to watch, highlighting Prewitt as someone who possesses a soaring, nuanced, and expressive voice and writes with devastating honesty. On September 13th, 2019, Prewitt released Expectations, the title track from her full-length debut. Additional singles from this project were subsequently released, Loving Her on October 21st, 2019, and Out of the Blue on November 15th, 2019. On February 1st, 2020, Prewitt's debut album, Expectations, was released by Rounder Records. She earned a nomination for Emerging Act of the Year at the 2020 American Music Honors and Awards. The same year, she duetted with Canadian singer-songwriter Donovan Woods on She Waits for Me to Come Back Down, a track from his album, Without People. In 2021, the artist was part of the Newport Folk Festival in July of that year. I would recommend her as well. One of those times when it's an opening act and you're like, do we want to go see the opening act or should we just wait and go see the main act? But as it turned out, not that we were making any real effort to get there to see her, traffic from where we live up in Evanston down into the city was not nearly as bad as we anticipated it might be. From our good buddy Rick's house, Rick and Ben's house, it was just a very short walk over. So we got there early enough to really get a good part of Prewitt's set, and I'm glad we did. It was great to hear her come out and sing with Lake Street Dive, and I thought that she and Rachel, their voices really sounded well together. They really did a great job, and I just was very, very impressed all the way around by their performance. And like I say, would be quick to recommend them to anybody who might like to go see some good music. So that was a very, very fun time seeing a couple of great musicians. Now we're going to move on for a minute, and we're going to talk about former Grateful Dead lighting director Candace Brightman. Candace is an American lighting engineer. She's known for her longtime association with the Grateful Dead. She is the sister of author Carol Brightman. Candace grew up in Illinois and studied set design at St. John's College in Annapolis. She began working as a lighting technician in the Anderson Theater in New York and was recruited by Bill Graham to operate lighting at the Fillmore East. In 1970, she operated the house lights at the Chicago Coliseum with Noral Trativ. She also has worked for Janis Joplin, Joe Cocker, and Van Morrison. No lightweights there. After serving as house lighting engineer for several Grateful Dead shows, including their 1971 residency at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, which we've talked about frequently on this podcast, she was recruited by Jerry Garcia to work for the band full time. She started working regularly for the Dead on their 1972 tour of Europe, later released, of course, as the Europe 72 album, and then later on the full release of all 22 shows from the tour, and remained there in-house lighting engineer for the remainder of their career. One particular challenge that Brightman faced was having to alter lighting setups immediately in response to the Dead's improvisational style. By the band's final tours in the mid-1990s, she was operating a computer-controlled lighting system and managing a team of technicians. Her work inspired Phish's resident lighting engineer, Chris Kuroda, who regularly studied techniques in order to keep up with her standards. Brightman continued working in related spin-off projects until 2005. She returned to direct the lighting for the Fare Thee Well concerts in 2015 out in San Jose and back in Chicago, where she used over 500 different fixtures to make up the lighting. It turns out, unfortunately, that Candace is now facing significant financial and health-related issues. And what's nice to see is that the rock and roll world hasn't forgotten about her, and people are coming out to speak up for her and to say really nice things about her. And let's see, because I've got some of it here. So this past July, a GoFundMe campaign was created to support financial and medical needs for Candace, who, as we said, first gained fame for her role as the lighting director at Fillmore East in 68. Her entry point to that role took place earlier in the year when a recent college graduate working at Bloomingdale's saw an ad calling for a lighting designer at the Anderson Theater on the Lower East Side. She assumed the venue was producing plays and was surprised to discover that it was hosting rock concerts. On the day that lighting director Chip Monk had agreed to offer introductory tutelage, Monk was a no-show, leaving Brightman to fend for herself. She acquitted herself admirably and soon moved on to the nearby Fillmore. We talked about Jerry checking her out. He saw her during a John McLaughlin show in Buffalo, New York, where he and Howard Wales had opened. Garcia had previously seen her in action not only at the Fillmore, but also at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester. Brightman remained the Dead's lighting designer through Garcia's passing, with a very brief hiatus, and was one of the first women in the concert industry to occupy such a role. In Brightman's honor, three fellow Grateful Dead alums have shared their thoughts on her career. Longtime front-of-house manager Dan Healy, production electrician light operator Danny English, and publicist Dennis McNally. And I'm just going to give you a couple of snippets of it because it's just it's a great thing. Dan Healy says, Candace had a way of moving the audience the whole evening. She would start with something, and by two-thirds of the way through, she would have the audience in the palm of her hand. What she did wasn't contrived. She didn't do a lot of flashy stuff to get everybody crazy. When the music started, it was like a jam session for her. She would do it without ever getting to a point where it became hokey or it was done just for the purpose of eliciting a reaction. I've seen that from plenty of people who do lights for some famous bands. Poor lights can make the audience angry or irritable. She had a way of putting everybody at ease and putting everybody in a musical mood and a musical mode. It just worked. Candace didn't do it as a form of manipulation. It just came out of her because she was so in love with what she did and in love with the prospects of what her art could do, that when left to her own devices, she just did it. She opened her heart and put not just her hands, but her whole self into it. Dennis McNally said, there was the time when she asked for a bigger budget at a band meeting, and Jerry said, I have no idea why anybody wants to watch us. It's probably her, so give her the money. She brought into the Grateful Dead, she bought into the Grateful Dead ethic of continuous exploration while always striving to be better. Just as Healy experimented with sound, she did the exact same thing. There were lights called Panaspots that could move and change color. They were more expensive, and she convinced the band to expand her palette. Danny English said, one of our goals was to enhance, but certainly not overshadow the music. Plus, the Grateful Dead, you can get it wrong very often. In other words, you think there's a big moment coming up. Well, there's not. Or all of a sudden, you're flat-footed, and there's a big moment that happened, and you're not there. So we were always on our toes, ready to try and finesse ourselves into the scene of what was happening. So this is just such a nice thing that these guys do, talking about her and really building up what's going on around here. We can't forget about the people who surrounded the Grateful Dead and made them so great. And Candace is somebody who just doesn't really get enough attention, in my opinion, for those of us who were at that shows. You know, given the technology that existed at the time, we thought that the Grateful Dead's lighting shows were absolutely stellar and just such an integral part of the whole thing. And then they seemed to be so advanced in the industry. You'd go and see other bands and their light shows, and they never really seemed to stack up to the Dead lights at all, different angles and flashing on and off, matching the beat of the music. And Candace told a story once about how the Dead were on stage and early on in her career, and she was doing the lighting. And later on, they came back to her and said that lighting was so perfect. You really just had it with every beat. How long did you study that? And she said, quite frankly, I didn't know what song it was. I just started going along with it, and it all seemed to work out. And that's kind of typical, I think, of right the way that the Grateful Dead always were. One of them would start noodling on something, another would pick it up. The third one would lean into it a little more. The drummers would give it a couple of beats, and boom, they'd be into a song that maybe they didn't even consider playing at that point in time. But that was the whole Dead experience, right? That you just never knew that at any moment things could go in any direction. They could blow up spectacularly in a bad way, or they could succeed in an amazing way that would only, and I guess either direction would further enhance the band's reputation. Because as Deadheads, we knew instinctively that on any night we were just as likely to see a major screw up as we were to see a peak moment. Not to say they screwed up all the time, but they certainly had their share. You know, they were not one of these plastic perfect bands that, you know, every single note was played perfectly because they knew exactly what was coming next and they had rehearsed it over and over. They were, I think, as Stephen Stills described them, a garage band. You know, they would just go out there and start jamming away and waiting for it all to kind of find its way together to a point where all of a sudden they were on the same page. You know, for the audience, it seemed magical. For them, it might have seemed the same way. But imagine, you know, being the lighting person trying to match up with that. And I love the fact that CK5, Chris Kuroda, the Fish, was a fan of Candace and really studied her work. I think most people would agree that today CK kind of rules the lighting industry in the concert industry, and does an absolutely amazing job. And the things we see with his lights are so far advanced down the road. And it's nice to think that it's just a line of succession, you know, from Chipmunk, who was famous for back at Woodstock and other famous concerts back in the day, on to Candace Brightman, you know, on to Chris Kuroda, and whoever comes next. And it's just so important to remember these people and all of the great things that they've brought to us. And I wish nothing but the best for Candace, and hope that everything does work out for her as well as it can, and congratulate the Grateful Dead family for not foregoing one of their own in a moment of need, and not just that, but coming back and having so many wonderful things to say about her. And I thank Relics for this wonderful content, and would urge you all to go to relics.com and catch out this article, which was just posted this past Friday, or Saturday, actually. Was it Friday or Saturday? Well, either way, it's a great article, and it goes on and on and on this past Friday. And Dan and Dennis and Danny have just a wonderful conversation about her, and really reveal some very funny stories, some stories that give you a lot of great insight. For some of you who are technical guys, you're going to appreciate what they have to say. Definitely go check it out if you have the opportunity, because it is really good. And again, best of luck to Candace. You made us all smile, and hopefully we can all now do the same for you. I also want to point out that Neil Young and his new band, the Chrome Hearts, are out jamming. And I just happened to notice an article that says, we talked about where they delivered a 13-minute version of Down by the River on night one at the Capitol Theater, where they played recently. Thank God he's okay. Thank God he is playing. But I have to tell you, my buddies and I still cannot believe that the Neil with Crazy Horse show did not go down in Chicago at the end of May this year as scheduled. We've told the story about the last-minute cancellation literally 2 hours before show time, friends in from out of town. We had all been pre-partying down at good buddy H's place in the city, and we're all ready to head outside and hop into a Uber and make our way over there as our phones all started buzzing telling us that the show was canceled. We later talked about the stories where Neil came out and said that it wasn't any one thing. He just woke up on the bus one day and said, that day, not any one day, that day, and said, "Now I just don't think I can do this. I don't think my body can do it right now, and I have to listen to my body." And while it's hard to argue with that, those of us that got the short end of the stick really feel like we missed something, and we did. And you know, now he's back out there playing these cranking shows. He's done some acoustic, he's doing some electric. You know, a 13-minute down by the river, I'm in on that. That's, you know, that's what I'm there to see. Powderfinger, all of this great stuff. So I certainly wish the best to Neil. Congratulate him and the Chrome Hearts on, you know, coming out and playing so well. But for God's sakes, please make your way back to Chicago and give us a chance to see you because we desperately wanted to. And are very sad that we didn't. So that's our music news for the day. Always fun to get in there and see what's going on and talk about it. And we're going to get back to our current music news, which is the show 31 years ago from today. Back on September 30th, 1993, at the old Boston Garden. And let's move on for a minute here and dive back in to a song which is one that I really, really like a lot and was happy to see them play. Written by Robbie Robertson, was released on his album, solo album, Robbie Robertson, on October 27th, 1987. It reached number 29 on the RPM Can-Can charts in 1988. Rod Stewart recorded a version of Broken Arrow in 1991 for his album Vagabond Heart. Stewart's version of the song was released as a single in August of 1991 with an accompanying music video, reaching number 20 on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100 chart and number 2 in Canada. The ballad is not to be confused either with Chuck Berry's 1959 single or Buffalo Springfield's 1967 song of the same name that was written by Neil Young. Broken Arrow was performed live by the Grateful Dead from 93 to 95 with Phil Lesh on vocals. Since that time, Grateful Dead spinoff groups, The Dead, Phil Lesh and Friends, and the other ones have performed the song each time with Lesh on vocals. It's a beautiful, beautiful song. And one of the things I loved about it for Phil was it, you know, another song for him to add to his little repertoire of songs he was singing for the Dead at the time. But it was a great song. He really sounds good on this one. Very energetic, really clean voice, and, you know, really kind of capturing, I think, some of the emotion in the song that Robbie created when he wrote it and when he performed it. It was a song that I was long familiar with because we'd all heard of Robbie Robertson, and when that album came out, it got a lot of airplay. A lot right along with the song Showdown at Big Sky, which was also on that album, and another Robbie Robertson tune that I spent a lot of time listening to back in the 80s and early 90s. Still do. But Broken Arrow was just a lot of fun. We loved it. It gave Phil another chance to shine. The band really seemed to enjoy playing it. They played it 35 times. The first was on October 23rd, 23rd, 1993, at the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum, and it was last played on July 2nd, 1995, at Deer Creek Music Center. One of the first times that I saw Phil and friends after he had made his recovery and he came back, I want to say was sometime in the early 2000s, maybe 2003 or 4, and Phil and friends actually played a show up at Alpine Valley, and my wife and I went up there to see it, and it was great. He played this song, and it was wonderful to hear it. I think he also played it with the other ones up there too, I want to say. Every time we heard him, it was just always a treat, a lot of fun, because it's a great song and a song that we really loved hearing him play. And on a night of covers, here's another big one.
In a train in a station with plasticine border, with cooking glass time. Money cold, answer my phone. The girl with kaleidoscope eye.
Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, a song by the Beatles from their May 1967 album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It was written primarily by John Lennon with assistance from Paul McCartney and credited to the Lennon-McCartney songwriting partnership. Lennon's son Julian supposedly inspired the song with a nursery school drawing that he called Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Shortly before the album's release, speculation arose that the first letter of each of the nouns in the title intentionally spelled LSD, the initialism commonly used for hallucinogenic drug lysergic acid diethylamide. Lennon repeatedly denied that he had intended it as a drug song and attributed the song's fantastical imagery to his reading of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. The Beatles recorded Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds in March 1967. Adding to the song's ethereal qualities, the musical arrangement included a Lowry organ part heavily treated with studio effects and a drone provided by an Indian tambura. The song has been recognized as a key work in the psychedelic genre. Among its many cover versions, a 1974 recording by Elton John with a guest appearance by Lennon was number one hit in the U.S. and Canada. John Lennon said that his inspiration for the song came when his three-year-old son Julian showed him a nursery school drawing that he called Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, depicting his classmate Lucy O'Donnell. Julian later recalled, "I don't know why I called it that or why it stood out from all my other drawings, but I obviously had an affection for Lucy at that age. I used to show Dad everything I'd built or painted at school, and this one sparked off the idea." Ringo Starr witnessed the moment and said that Julian first uttered the song's title on returning home from nursery school. Lennon later said, "I thought, that's beautiful. I immediately wrote a song about it." According to Lennon, the lyrics were largely derived from the literary style of Lewis Carroll in Alice in Wonderland. John had read and admired Carroll's works, and the title of Julian's drawing reminded him of Which Dreamed It, chapter of Through the Looking Glass, in which Alice floats in a boat beneath a sunny sky. Lennon recalled in a 1980 interview, "It was Alice in the boat. She is buying an egg and turns it into Humpty Dumpty. The woman serving the shop turns into a sheep, and the next minute they are rowing in a rowboat somewhere, and I was visualizing that." Paul McCartney remembered of the song's composition, "We did the whole thing like an Alice in Wonderland idea, being in a boat on a river. Every so often it broke off and you saw Lucy in the sky with diamonds all over the sky. This Lucy was God, the big figure, the white rabbit. He later recalled helping Lennon finish the song at Lennon's Kenwood home, specifically claiming he contributed the newspaper taxis and cellophane flower lyrics. Lennon's 1968 interview with Rolling Stone magazine confirmed McCartney's contribution. Lucy O'Donnell Vaden, who lived in Surbiton, Surrey, died in September of 2009 of complications of lupus at the age of 46. Juliet had been informed of her illness and renewed their friendship before her death. Rumors again of the connection between the title of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and LSD began circulating shortly after the album's release. McCartney gave two interviews in June, admitting to having taken the drug. Lennon later said he was surprised at the idea. The title was a hidden reference to LSD, countering that the song wasn't about that at all, and it was purely unconscious that it came out to be LSD. Until someone pointed it out, I never even thought of it. I mean, who would ever bother to look at initials of a title? It's not an acid song. Well, maybe somebody who was on acid would. McCartney confirmed Lennon's claim on several occasions. In 1968, he said, "When you write a song and you mean it one way, and someone comes up and says something about it that you didn't think of, you can't deny it. Like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, people came up and said, cunningly, right, I get it, LSD. And it was when newspapers were talking about LSD, but we never thought about it." In a 2004 interview with Uncut magazine, McCartney confirmed it was pretty obvious drugs did influence some of the group's compositions at that time, including Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, though he tempered this statement by adding, "It's easy to overestimate the influence of drugs on the Beatles' music." I love that quote, because he's, you know, he's acknowledging their use, but at the same time taking credit and not trying to say that this is all just drug-induced stuff. They were actually very bright, creative lads, as they might say, and they got it done very well. In 2009, Julian with James Scott Cook and Todd Meagher released Lucy, a song that is a quasi-follow-up of the Beatles song. The cover of the EP showed four-year-old Julian's original drawing that is now owned by David Gilmour of Pink Floyd fame. Lennon's original handwritten lyrics sold at auction in 2011 for $230,000. It's a lot of fun to see this tune live. I love that Jerry does the singing, even though his voice is very rough, and he stumbles through some of the lyrics. It's a Beatles tune, a legendary rock tune, and Jerry sings like he wrote it at the kitchen table. Phil and Friends with the quintet cover the tune as well, and I believe Warren Haynes does the primary singing on their version. Warren, Jimmy Herring, and Phil really rock that tune like the veteran rockers that they are. This particular version is fun because it opens the second set, a place of real prominence even after having played it for 6 months by this point. And what a great way to start a second set. You got to keep the Deadheads guessing. The boys played it 19 times in concert. First time was March 17, 1993 at the Capitol Center in Landover, Maryland. And they last played it on June 28, 1995 at the Palace in Auburn Hills, Michigan. We are now going to shift over and have a little bit of talk about marijuana news today. So, Dan, why don't you lead us in with that? Thank you, Dan. You keep coming up with them. That is Stoned at the Jukebox by Hank Williams Jr. It came out on the album Hank Williams Jr. and Friends. It's the 26th studio album by Hank Williams Jr. Let's just stop and think about that kind of content for a minute. 26 studio albums. That's a lot of freaking songs. Hank Williams and Jr. and Friends was an album featuring Williams' own unique style as opposed to imitating his father's. The album sound has been classified as country rock, southern rock, and outlaw country. According to Williams' autobiography, Living Proof, the album was recorded in Muscle Shoals, Alabama at Music Mill Studios between February and July 1975. The album insert says that it was recorded at Capricorn Studios in Macon, Georgia. So believe what you want to believe. Either way, Hank Williams Jr., Stoned at the Jukebox, great tune, a lot of fun. Thank you for that, Dan. And let's dive into our marijuana news of the day. And we have a lot of interesting stories going on in this area, as we typically tend to do. And as I get them up on my big screen here, we're going to start off with a story. And we've talked about the Ukraine and marijuana before, and way, way back at the very beginning of the Russia-Ukraine war, we even had a recording of a Ukrainian citizen who was being interviewed on a bus that had brought a lot of Ukrainian citizens out of Ukraine, and I, off the top of my head, don't recall what country they had brought them into to protect them, but when they interviewed this one young Ukrainian dude, his comment was all about thank good God for marijuana, and he brought all of his marijuana, and how nice it was going to be that he had his marijuana if they had to be away from home. We all got a little bit of a chuckle out of that. But it turns out that the Ukrainian government has approved a list of health conditions that will qualify patients for medical marijuana under the country's cannabis law that was enacted by President Volodymyr Zelensky last month. By the way, thank you as always to Marijuana Moment and Kyle Yeager for this wonderful content. On Friday, Ukraine's Ministry of Health revealed a list of about 20 qualifying conditions for which medical cannabis can be prescribed to patients, while noting that additional conditions could be added down the line if they're deemed medically appropriate. Those conditions include multiple sclerosis, neuropathy, shingles, cerebral palsy, spinal cord injuries, complications from chemotherapy, Parkinson's disease, childhood epilepsy, and weight loss associated with eating disorders. The ministry also noted that a medical advisory committee could still approve additional conditions in the future. While Zelensky and other officials have said access to medical cannabis can help soldiers address physical and mental wounds incurred during the nation's ongoing war with Russia, it doesn't appear at this time that post-traumatic stress disorder is a qualifying condition, despite some supporters suggesting as much as the medical marijuana bill moved through the legislative process. Taking a medicinal product based on cannabis should be stopped if the desired therapeutic effect is not obtained within 4 to 12 weeks, or in case of serious adverse reaction, including those related to the mental state, the health ministry said, according to a translation. We remind you that all activities related to medical cannabis will be strictly controlled by the state, and the recreational non-medical use of cannabis remains prohibited. As the country is prepared for the rollout of its medical cannabis program, it's also been able to start importing marijuana products since cannabis was moved from list 1 to list 2 of the country's drug code, making it available for medical use with a prescription. Lawmakers approved the medical cannabis legislation last December, but the opposition Batkivichana, if I pronounce that right, party used a procedural tactic to block it by forcing consideration of a resolution to repeal the measure. That resolution failed in January, clearing its path for enactment. Opponents previously tried to derail the marijuana bill by filing hundreds of what critics called spam amendments, but that attempt failed, with the measure ultimately passing with 284 votes. Zelensky, for his part, has voiced support for medical marijuana legalization last June, stating in an address to the parliament that all the world's best practices, all the most effective policies, all the solutions, no matter how difficult or usual they may seem to us, must be applied in Ukraine so that Ukrainians, all our citizens, do not have to endure pain, stress, and the trauma of war. In particular, we must finally fairly legalize cannabis-based medicines for all those who need them, with appropriate scientific research and controlled Ukrainian production, he said. So I happen to think that's a very marvelous thing. And for a country that's at war and has been at war for a while, it is a great thing for the soldiers. It is a great thing for the population. We've talked about how Israel, Rafael Meshulam, studied and tested cannabis-based products for the impact that they might have on Israeli soldiers who were coming in contact with it in various Arab villages. I think it's great for Ukraine to be open about it and to move forward. Yes, there's a little bit of, you know, Eastern European language, and there the state will control everything, and we haven't, you know, legalized everything yet, and don't smoke it if you're not a patient. And I get that, you know, they have their right, just like every part of the United States started off with saying that if you weren't a patient, you still didn't have the right to smoke marijuana. So, you know, that's a good place for them to start. But I especially love that, you know, even in the time of amidst of war, where all of their attention and energy is primarily focused, that they're not laying down in other areas, and that they still took the time to approve marijuana and to allow it to go forward for the benefit of their population, their soldiers, and everyone else. And I think that that's a great move by Ukraine. I think that's a great move by Zelensky. And congratulations to them for moving in a forward direction with this and not backwards. Now, another law that's coming through on a bipartisan basis, no less, is that senators have introduced a bill to mandate the automatic sealing of criminal records for certain nonviolent federal marijuana and other drug convictions. The legislation, titled the Clean Slate Act, was filed by Senators Bob Casey, a Democrat of Pennsylvania, and Rand Paul, a Republican of Kentucky, on Wednesday. It would further provide a pathway for people to petition for record sealing if the offense is not covered under the automatic relief provisions. Automatically sealing records is an opportunity for millions of Americans to get a second chance at life, Casey said in a press release. This legislation will ensure that parents, workers, and families who have successfully completed their sentence can build successful lives that are unburdened by minor nonviolent criminal history. The measure is a Senate companion to a House bill sponsored by Reps Lisa Blunt of Rochester, a Democrat, and Nancy Mace, a Republican from South Carolina, that was filed last year. The legislation has been introduced over the last several sessions, and a previous version advanced through the House Judiciary Committee in 2022. It wasn't ultimately taken up on the floor, however. A one-pager to the Senate proposal says it would automatically seal an individual's federal criminal record 1 year after their completed sentence if they have been convicted of simple drug possession or a covered nonviolent offense involving marijuana. It also calls for the sealing of arrest records and other related records for individuals who have been acquitted, exonerated, or never had charges filed against them. In introducing the Senate companion bill to the Clean Slate Act of 2023, Senators Casey and Paul showcase a deep understanding of the far-reaching benefits of clean state legislation. Sheena Mead, CEO of the Clean Slate Initiative, said, "Beyond ensuring individuals can earn a fair chance at redemption, clean state policies catalyze economic growth and bolster our workforce. By removing barriers to employment and opportunity, clean state legislation enables individuals to fully participate in our economy, driving growth and prosperity," she said. So far, states have led the change on automatic record sealing, and it's encouraging to see momentum building in Congress. Together, we can break down barriers to opportunity and ensure everyone has a fair chance to build a better future for themselves and to reach their potential. This is great on a bipartisan basis. Is the country coming together to say we're not going to let these types of convictions, which in the face of where states are legalizing these days really seem kind of silly, but yet still have the impact, the negative impact of prejudicing individuals who are applying for jobs with employers who go back and do complete background checks, which is most employers these days, to want to know what they're fighting. And while prior marijuana use or conviction is not necessarily a deal killer for every employer out there, for many of them it is. And it's disappointing because, as we've talked many, many times on this show, it shouldn't be, right? If it's not for alcohol, if it's not for tobacco, if it's not for nicotine, for God's sakes, it shouldn't be for THC, which is far less damaging and destructive to people, and far less work hours are lost to marijuana than to these other substances. And these should be sealed. And you know, that's fair to say, as long as there's not violence, you know, depending on the volume of marijuana we're talking about, you know, these factors should properly be taken into consideration, because nothing is an automatic. There's always going to be exceptions. There's always going to be places where you have to draw the line. And as long as the majority of people are going to ultimately be protected, that's a fair thing, and that's the way it should be, especially if we're talking about the possibility of federal legalization down the road. And this is an issue that the article refers to, that so many people in states run into, because not every state, like Illinois and others, have led the way. New York on saying that the states are going to provide an opportunity for individuals who had previously been arrested or convicted under, again, you know, basic state marijuana laws, not involving violence and not involving large amounts, to have a chance for these people to have their slate wiped cleaned as well, to be exonerated or whatever else any particular state wants to do with respect to convictions of these types. So thank you to the federal government. Thank you for bipartisan support and for people on both sides of the aisle to be able to see that this can be detrimental. And of course, it doesn't matter if it's a red state or a blue state, because people smoke marijuana in every state. And as a result, every state potentially faces this problem. And to allow for the feds to come in and do that, I think it also sends a signal, hopefully, to the states that haven't gotten on board with this yet, that it's very difficult to say we're going to legalize marijuana for commercial commercial sale and for the financial benefit of individuals in the state, while we still enforce convictions and penalties that have already been placed on people previously for marijuana use. That just doesn't seem fair, and hopefully they'll figure it out. Now, here's another great reason seen from the opposite extreme as to why states should be legalizing marijuana. With Pennsylvania, lawmakers under pressure to act on marijuana legalization when they reconvene next week, new data is underscoring the urgency, revealing more than 12,000 people were arrested for cannabis possession in the Keystone State last year. Put differently, that means Pennsylvania police make an average of 32 marijuana possession arrests each day. The data from the National Incident-Based Reporting System and Uniform Crime Reporting System shows in 2023, 10,463 adults and 1,578 juveniles were arrested for possession of up to 30 grams of marijuana. And consistent with national enforcement trends, those arrests have disproportionately affected black residents of the state. While about 75% of Pennsylvania's population is white, black people account for 40% of the cannabis arrests. I think that the ongoing arrests in Pennsylvania should motivate lawmakers as it did in other states, said Chris Goldstein, a Normal regional organizer who received a presidential pardon for his own federal cannabis possession case. And he told this to Marijuana Moment last Friday. While more than 80 cities in the state have moved forward with locally decriminalizing, reducing penalties for simple possession, the fact that there are still upwards of 12,000 arrests statewide makes Pennsylvania stand out nationally as having some of the most arrests of any state in America at this point, Goldstein, who compiled the new enforcement data, said. But even as Pennsylvania has become an island of prohibition, surrounded by states that have enacted adult use legalization, such as Ohio, Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, and New York, Goldstein says he doesn't feel the latest push for reform in the legislature will deliver results this session, which he attributes to the ongoing obstinance of certain GOP leadership. There are plenty of Democrats who've offered well-thought bills over the years, and they just have never gotten anywhere. And there are even some well-thought bills from Republicans over the years, and those haven't gotten anywhere, he said. That's because people in leadership positions block those bills from moving forward. Earlier this month, Representative Aaron Coffer, a Republican, and Emily Kincaid, a Democrat, formally introduced a bipartisan marijuana legalization bill alongside 15 other co-sponsors. In July, the governor of Pennsylvania said the administration and lawmakers would come back and continue to fight for marijuana legalization and other policy priorities that were omitted from budget legislation that was signed into law last month. When the Pennsylvania legislature approved the budget bill that Governor Josh Shapiro enacted, lawmakers also accidentally left medical marijuana dispensaries out of a section providing tax relief for the cannabis industry, and it hasn't been clear whether the omission could be fixed without future legislative action. What happens after the legislature reconvenes for the remainder of the session next week is uncertain, but a poll released this week found that a strong majority of Pennsylvania voters in five key toss-up districts are in favor of legalizing marijuana in the state, and they want to see lawmakers enact the reform immediately. So, you know, again, here's another situation where we have the citizens of a state telling their state legislators what they want to do. And the question is, will the state legislators actually follow through on this pass laws that their citizens are telling them they want? It's ridiculous for a state like marijuana that size to have 32 people on average arrested every day for THC possession. Now, one thing they said in there that I will agree with, though, is that even if they legalize marijuana, for those people who are underage, if they're possessing marijuana, it is exposing them to potential criminal dangers. But perhaps they can be like the city of Chicago and decriminalize it. So if it's 14 grams or less, it's basically a traffic ticket, right? Because that way, even younger people, we can still say, look, we recognize that even though you shouldn't be smoking marijuana, it's not as bad of a thing that if you are, your whole lives should be ruined any more than we would punish somebody who's drinking a beer, as long as they don't get in a car afterwards, right? So these are distinctions that we need to be able to make as we go forward, and we should not have states who are arresting so many people. 12,000 people over the course of a year is a ridiculous number. It's a waste of resources for the state. It's a waste of resources for those who get arrested and have to defend themselves. And quite frankly, it's not fair to those people who get arrested and all of a sudden see themselves thrown into the midst of the Pennsylvania criminal law system. And that's just not okay. One final article, thank you again, from Marijuana Moment. This is actually a good one. What people are finding is that the hemp leaf extract containing cannabidiol, CBD, could be a promising new natural insecticide, according to a new study that found it effectively killed larvae of mosquitoes that spread yellow fever, including one variety of the insect that's resistant to conventional insecticides. The study, published this summer in the journal Insects, found that hemp leaf extract with above a certain concentration of CBD killed the larva of the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which spreads diseases such as dengue, Zika, and yellow fever within about 2 days. The effects were seen in both mosquitoes that are susceptible to insecticides as well as mosquitoes that are resistant. Authors from Ohio State University wrote that CBD appears to be the principal active ingredient responsible for the larvicidal activity. The work was led by entomology graduate student Eric Martinez Rodriguez and was inspired by earlier research showing that the bark of a plant native to Madagascar could also be used as a natural insecticide and bug repellent. Mosquitoes are one of the deadliest animals in the world, mainly because as adults they serve as vectors of disease, Martinez Rodriguez said in a university press release. It's very important to be able to control these pests at an early stage when they are most vulnerable. How exactly the CBD extract is killing the pests, however, remains an open question. The specific mode of action of CBD toxicity against mosquitoes and other insects, the report says, is unknown. Intriguingly, insects are one of the few animal groups that do not possess conical cannabinoid receptors. However, at least in mammalian systems, CBD is known to modulate a wide range of biochemical targets. Thus, CBD likely affects multiple biochemical targets in tissue and insects. Remarkably, very little CBD was needed to kill the mosquito larvae, Martinez Rodriguez explained. If you compare the amount of hemp extract needed to kill 50% of the population to other synthetic conventional insecticides, it's on the high side, the researcher said. But when compared side by side to other natural extracts we have tested in our lab, only a relatively low amount is required to produce high mortality rates in larvae. The author said the research are consistent with previous studies that have found the concentration-dependent larvicidal activity of hemp extracts against other mosquitoes, pointing out at least five other mosquito species that are vulnerable to CBD extracts. So this is another great story, and this is very important as we see a lot of states and the federal government trying to take a very much harsher, stricter tone with the CBD industry because they're all pissed off that they didn't do their homework back before they voted on the 2018 Farm Bill to legalize hemp and all of its constituent cannabinoids. And 6 or 7 years later, when they're finally realizing it, not that there's any problems and not that anybody's reported anything wrong with this, we don't have huge crews of people going out and smoking Delta 8 or any of the other hemp-sourced THC products that are out there, right? But we have states and the federal government saying, oh, no, we've got to roll back very heavily on CBD and on hemp and commercial hemp and its potential uses, which, of course, is exactly the wrong way to go because you can't really put the genie back in the bottle. There's too many people out there who have invested in this, and there's no reason to. There's just absolutely no reason to, and I'm not going to get into that rant again, but go back and listen to prior episodes if you have to, because there's just no reason whatsoever for any of these people to have done that in the first place. And again, here's another natural use for it, and many people who live in areas where big mosquito populations exist ought to be very happy to see that this exists, and hopefully this is something that can receive some approval and really have a chance to get out there in the world. So lots of good stuff going on in the marijuana industry and in the marijuana world internationally here on the health front. And we're not even going to waste our time today with articles about people who are saying stupid things about it because there's no need when there's so many good things to say about it. So let's dive back into our show from 31 years ago today at the Old Boston Garden with another Phil Lesh show, a second Phil Lesh show in this performance.
Sunder is lightning.
Since Wave to the Wind, it's a Hunter Lesch tune that was never released. In fact, there are articles disputing whether there even is a known studio recording of the song. I can't say that it's a necessarily a great song. I have no real memory of it other than it shows up in song lists for a couple of shows I attended. But even this version of the tune is really kind of flat and uninspiring. But there are a lot of Phil tunes to feature, and you can only discuss Box of Rain or Broken Arrow or Tom Thumb Blues so many times. It's just something different to talk about, and love the fact that, here in the 90s, Phil, who famously didn't sing from the mid-70s into the mid-80s, was still taking such a strong position and stepping up to the microphone and taking the time to write new tunes to premiere as well. So this song was played 21 times, first on February 22nd, 1992, at the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum, and the last time it was played was December 9th, 1993, at the Los Angeles Sports Arena. So basically kind of over a two-year period, and then they kind of tucked that one away, and we never heard it again. And I don't think I've even heard it in subsequent Phil shows. I'm trying to think if I've ever heard it at a Phil and Friends show, and I can't say that I have, not to say that he hasn't played it. But again, if I have, it's not one that particularly sticks out. But as I say, when you've written Box of Rain, one of the top two or three Grateful Dead songs, and certainly in my Hall of Fame, one of the top rock and roll songs of all time, you're entitled to have a couple of flat ones. So no stress here for Phil. Now, before we lead into our final show, our final song for the day that we're going to feature from this concert from 31 years ago today, first I want to give a birthday shout-out to my nephew Jacob Mishkin, star collegiate baseball player, turns 21 soon, and all I can say is no effing way. Happy birthday, dude. Hard to believe, but here you are. Look forward to celebrating with you. I also want to shout out a happy and healthy new year to those celebrating Rosh Hashanah, which begins this week, Wednesday night and into Thursday and Friday, for those who celebrated 2 days. It's still feels like summer here in Chicago, so very excited. You know, it was wonderful to be able to be outside for Lake Street Dive, and looking forward to lots of other good music as we go along. Shout out to a good buddy Kevin, who is in Las Vegas with his parents back at the Sphere. He's a legend. He's out there to see Fish. He went to see Dead and Company, and now he went out there to take his parents to go see the Eagles. So I'll have to get a report from him on that. Maybe we can talk about that next week as well. But all that stuff is really going on. So get out there and enjoy your music. We're going to close out with a great version, in my opinion, of the other one. And what's interesting about this other one, we're ending on the other one. We're not ending with the encore. They go from the other one into, a reasonably good Wharf Rat, Not Fade Away, and then an absolutely lovely Broke Down Palace encore. But we've talked about all those songs a lot recently, and I wanted to dive back into the other one because I don't think it ever gets enough attention. The Full Suite, that's it for the other one, was written by the Dead. It was released on their second studio album, Anthem of the Sun, back on July 18th, 1968. It's made up of four sections. We've talked about this before. Cryptical Envelopment, Quad Libet for Tenderfeet, The Faster We Go, The Rounder We Get, and We Leave the Castle. Like other tracks on the album, it's a combination of studio and live performances mixed together to create the final product. While We Leave the Castle portion of the song was never performed live by the band, the first three sections were all featured in concert to different extents. Cryptical Envelopment, written and sung by Garcia, was performed from 67 to 71, when it was then dropped aside from a few selective performances in 85, which we've talked about. The Faster We Go, The Rounder We Get, written by Kreutzmann and Weir, was sung by Weir, became one of the band's most frequently performed songs in concert, and that is the segment of the suite that we denote simply as the other one, and that we all heard in concert so much. One of the few Grateful Dead songs to have lyrics written by Weir, The Faster We Go, The Rounder We Get, a.k.a. The Other One, became one of the Dead's most played songs, being performed well over 500 times, and one of their most popular vehicles for improvisation, with some performances reaching 30 minutes in length. The song's lyrics reference the influence of the Merry Pranksters, and in particular Neil Cassidy. Additionally, the line, "The heat came round and busted me for smiling on a cloudy day," one of my all-time favorite Grateful Dead lyrics, refers to a time Weir was arrested for throwing a water balloon at a cop from the upstairs of 710 Ashbury, the Dead's communal home during the 60s and early 70s, before the band moved its headquarters and the band members across the Golden Gate Bridge to Marin County. In my experience, this was almost always a second set tune. Back in the late 80s, or excuse me, the late 60s and early 70s, either a full "That's It" for "The Other One" or just "The Other One" would be jammed out as long as Dark Star, and sometimes even longer. During the Europe 72's tour, Dark Star and the full "Other One" suite traded off every other show as the second set psychedelic rock jam that would, you know, be played out anywhere from 20 to 30, 35 minutes. When we would hear it in concert, The Other One was often preceded by a Phil bass bomb to bring the independent noodling into a full and tight jam with an energy all of its own. Supposedly, The Other One got its name because it was being written at the same time as Alligator, which was believed to be the very first original Grateful Dead tune. And when discussing their tunes, they would always discuss about Alligator and this other one that we're recording. So it kind of adopted, picked up the name from there. I always loved The Other One, was lucky enough to see the full "That's It" for The Other One suite twice in 1985 during its two brief comeback to celebrate the Dead's 20th anniversary that year, both out at the Greek Theater, and then later in the fall of that year at the Starlight Theater in Kansas City. They played it, as we said, 550 times, first on July 31st, 1967 at Winterland Arena in San Francisco, and it was last played July 8th, 1995 at Soldier Field in Chicago. Everyone have a great week. Really enjoy yourselves. Enjoy your holiday if you are celebrating. If not, enjoy beautiful weather. For those of you that may have been impacted by Hurricane Helene, good thoughts and hopes going out to you that you can recover and that your damage, whether personal or property, is very minimal, and that, like I say, you can all be back at full strength and living your lives again as soon as possible. Enjoy your week, everyone. Be safe and enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Here's The Other One.